Iowa is known for its crazy weather, but when hail or high winds damage your roof, you can depend on your insurance company to help you out. Or can you? This hour, navigating insurance claims. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, will be here. We'll talk about what you should do if your roof is damaged in a storm, how to communicate with your insurance adjuster, and how to figure out who to trust. Bill will also answer your questions about the home improvement projects in your life. Give us a call at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When big winds or nasty hailstorms come your way, sometimes your roof pays a pretty steep price, and then you get stuck with the bill. Most of us have insurance that's supposed to cover that kind of damage, but getting through the claims process can be tricky. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today to give us the knowledge we need to get through the process from Fort Dodge North. Hi, Bill.
Hey, morning, Charity. How are you doing?
Great. And actually, you're on the line with us from up in Minnesota today. So thanks for taking some time out of your vacation to talk with us.
Well, actually, we're starting to build a log cabin with some friends. So it's work. So I'm glad we're doing this morning because they're digging for footings and I'm sitting here looking at the lake. It's perfect.
Excellent. I'm glad I could get you out of some heavy lifting today.
Yeah,
so,
thanks.
Bill, of course, these storms come up without any warning, and then we have a bunch of hail or something bizarre happens in the weather in Iowa. When you go through a hailstorm and you want to check your roof to see if there's a problem, what do you do?
Well, you know, if you're able to get up on the roof, you know, that's great. You know, follow all the safety policies, putting, you know, ladder upright and everything, or have a friend or have a contractor come and take the roof, take a look at the roof. There's, you know, sometimes people will assume that, you know, because someone on the same street or around your area has roof damage that you also have it. And sometimes we don't. You know, you shouldn't feel hurt in any way if an adjuster comes by and says, you know, I don't see any hail damage or wind damage, storm damage whatsoever in your roof, even though your neighbor has it. A lot of times it depends on the type of the shingle, you know, how thick they are, what brand they are sometimes, you know, what trees maybe have protected the roof. But it's sometimes the easiest thing to do is after the storm, go over to your downspouts. And if there's small chunks of shingles laying there on the ground, then you need to get your insurance adjuster or call your insurance agent right away, because that's usually what happens is you know, either strong wind may tear a shingle a little bit, but usually if you get hail of any kind of size at all, it'll come down, it'll chip the very bottom of, we call them like the tab or the very bottom of that, of each individual shingle, and it'll bust it off, and then it'll, you know, the water will take it down to the gutters and then onto the downspout and out to the ground. And sometimes that's a, you know, a really is an indicator if you don't want to get up on the roof right away.
All right. And even if I do want to get up on the roof and take a look at it, I'm not exactly a roofing expert. What am I looking for? What can I see that tells me, okay, I better call somebody?
Well, you know, if you don't see anything at all, you still should call a roof, you know, either like a contractor that you may know, or, you know, you're paying, you know, good money to insurance companies. Have them come over anyway. You know, I mean, if they say, well, you probably didn't, you know, I don't care. I pay you good money. Get over here and look at my roof. But if you get on the roof and you see like little dimples sometimes after maybe a slight rain or if the sun hits it just right, you can see little, like somebody took a small hammer and put, you know, start kind of beating down your shingles a little bit. You'll see little dimples in the shingles, and sometimes it's really kind of fun when you get a mist or a dew, heavy dew. You can actually see every one of those because they're just a little bit darker. But then you can also take a look there again. You'll get right down and take a look at the edge of the shingle and see if it's been, you know, roughed up. Sometimes you can go up if it's halfway dark. Sometimes people will even go up in the evening, and you'll take a flashlight lay the flashlight down on the roof so that the beam of the light goes across the shingles, and you could see the little dips of where maybe the hail damaged the shingle or some large sticks came down and hit it. And there again, really look and see if any of the shingles, if there's a piece missing, something's caused that, or the shingles are so old that they're starting to fall apart and maybe it's time to re-roof anyway.
Okay. And so if I see some damage and I want to get a second opinion, do I call the insurance adjuster first or should I look for somebody who is not working for the insurance company?
You know, sometimes that's kind of a judgment call. If you know your insurance, you know your insurance company, your agent, you know, really well, you feel real comfortable with them, you've been with them for years, you can kind of expect, you know, that they are supposed to be looking out for you. And that's sometimes where we run into problems. Adjusters, you know, I've had problems with adjusters in the past. Some of them are just super. Some of them are just unbelievably unprofessional. I just get down to say they're jerks. And it just depends. So you've got to, if you feel comfortable with your insurance agent, call them and, you know, say, hey, do you want to send somebody out or do you want me to get a contractor to look at it? But in any case, a lot of times it's really good to have a second opinion anyway. So once you have an adjuster come take a look at your roof, if you're maybe not happy, you don't feel like you had the best adjuster there, inspect the claims adjuster, you know, looking at everything, then, you know, you can have a contractor take a look at it, another roofing contractor that maybe you feel comfortable with. And then in some policies, this is where it's really important, no matter what, just sit down and read word for word your insurance policy, probably even before you call the agent, to know what is covered in your specific policy, because there in some of the documents that you have a right to get another appraiser. If you're not happy with the one that was supplied by, say, the insurance company, you have the right to get another claims adjuster, either a public one or another private one, to come in and give another opinion. So in some policies, it's not there. In some, it is. So there's an awful lot in that paperwork that you have to look to see what applies to yours, because in some cases, let's say the claims adjuster said, okay, your roof is going to be $10,000 worth of damage, let's say. And then a contractor comes in and, hey, you know what? It ended up being $13,000. Well, you know, okay, what happens with that balance? And on some policies, if the contractor can prove that, hey, all this extra work was due to the hail damage, they will pay that extra $3,000. Even though they only gave you 10 in the beginning.
Okay, so you need to be really on top of this process and all of the costs. And I mean, you mentioned the insurance adjuster and you mentioned a roofing contractor. I see a little conflict there because, of course, the insurance adjuster is working for the insurance company. And as you said, they're supposed to be on your side. Not all of us have a close relationship with our insurance company, and they don't want to pay for a roof. But, of course, a roofing contractor would love to put a new roof on your house.
Yeah, and in some cases, that's where you may want to bring in somebody that doesn't have any skin in the game at all, somebody that knows maybe a contractor friend that maybe doesn't do it anymore, or you know, that's where you maybe have someone come in, like just a professional inspector, let's say. There's a lot of licensed inspectors around Iowa, and they will come and they'll inspect that. And they, you know, they know they're not going to get any work out of it, and they don't really care if they hurt the insurance company's feelings. They'll give you an honest one. But if you can find someone that just doesn't have any skin in the game, or a contractor that's very, you know, very reputable in your area, and especially if he's busy, a lot of times they go, well, hey, you know, I got so much work anyway, I probably can't do it. But it's good to have someone there with, sometimes the claims adjuster is out for himself. And I hate to say that, I mean, but that's just, like any other business, some are self-centered. I just ran into a case this last week where an insurance adjuster was great when the, let's say the husband was there, but when it was just the wife, he just kind of flipped into a whole other person. It was very extremely condescending, unprofessional, almost brought the homeowner into tears. That's not the kind of adjuster you want to have looking at it, and right away you'd say, you know what, get out of here. Let's bring somebody that's in a professional. But that's like any other business. There's always a bad egg.
And what do insurance adjusters, what kind of education do they get to be able to look at your roof? I mean, do they have to go through some sort of process?
Well, I was going to bring that up for you because, Charity, you and I, all we need to do is get on the Internet. And as long as we say we're reliable and honest, we can actually, Iowa, you don't have to be licensed. You don't have to be a claims adjuster. So there's no license. So I got on the Internet. And I said, okay, hey, let's just say I want to be an adjuster. And it said, well, what you do is you go like to Indiana. They have a licensing. So what you do is go online and say that you're a resident of Indiana. Okay, right there, that's kind of throwing some flags. Oh, you're like, yeah, I'm a citizen of Indiana. And then you take their test, their little online two-day class or whatever, and then you're an adjuster. You know, to me, that's kind of scary. It's like saying I could do that and be a car mechanic. I mean, there wouldn't be a car running in, you know, in Fort Dodge area if I worked on it. So taking a two-day course. So, sometimes it's scary. So that's why you want to ask them, hey, you know, let me ask them for a business card and say, since you're here, what education do you have? So if they've been going to, you know, a lot of extra courses and training courses, because the really good adjusters, like the ones that I've had personally for me, I swear they spend more time taking courses and professional education than they're actually out in the field. I mean, they're extremely professional, and I get on a roof with them, and I even start feeling intimidated because they know so much, and those guys are actually looking out for me. So there's such a wide range, and so that's why you just have to feel comfortable is what it comes down to.
All right, so you need to ask a lot of questions.
A lot, and a lot of research, but then it all comes down to, if you're not happy, you call your agent. Say, you know, I've been making payments to you for 30 years. Now I have a claim. You know, you're supposed to stand up for me. Well, if you're not happy, then your next recourse would be to get a hold of the Iowa Insurance Division. And you can file a complaint there. And you just get online and you go to that. It's the Iowa Insurance Division. You know, then you can either type up something and send it to them or, you know, talk to them and say, well, you know, this is what's occurring, and they'll help you out on it.
All right. Well, I know you've been helping some friends walk through this process lately. There have been a number of exciting storms in the last week or so in Iowa. And we'll take your questions now. It doesn't have to be about your roof or a hail damage. You can give us a call and ask Bill any question you have about your home improvement projects. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Bill McAnally is our home improvement expert. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here with us by phone today from up north in Minnesota. He's here to answer your questions about your home improvement projects. And, of course, we've been talking about roof damage. You can ask questions about roof damage, but you can ask questions about any of the home improvement projects in your life. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jim is on the line first in Spencer. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Hi, Bill. Well, you know, I did have hail damage, and I could see that, you know, the size of the hail and what it was doing, and didn't look very good to me. I called my insurance company, and then they sent out an adjuster, and he told me everything was, well, they said we were fine. Because I wasn't there when he came out. Anyway, wasn't long after that they canceled me, and then I noticed all the tabs are breaking off my shingles. And I'm wondering now, do I go back to them and say, excuse me, but that wasn't exactly the right answer, or do I have to go to some other agency and try to you know, get some records from them proving, you know, what they actually saw.
And Jim, you said they canceled your policy?
Yeah.
All right, so you had to switch to a new insurance company.
Right, so they're not my company. I was with them for probably 25 years.
Ooh. Yeah, they're not, in some of the policy information and stuff, when you check around it, they're not supposed to be able to cancel you because you make a claim. So after talking, I've talked with a couple legal people in the last few days about, you know, this kind of deal and what they came up with is get a hold of that Iowa Insurance Division and talk about that because if you saw damage and then now the tabs are busting off, you know, it probably had some good damage and there should be some records that you know, I'm sure that I shouldn't say I'm sure. Back that off. Cancel that. You know, I bet that there's some documentation. Yeah, hey, there was some damage or, and because why would they cancel you? I mean, there's got to be a reason that they cancel you. There has to be a reason that they say, you know, we're canceling you because, your house is in such disrepair. And if you
they said that they couldn't insure the roof. And I admit the roof was getting old. I was thinking that they might want to pay a portion of the replacement because, it was fine when before the hail, and now it's not.
Well, if they sent you that before the hailstorm, I'd say, yeah, that happens. Because if the roof isn't in good shape, no, they're not going to cover it. And if they would have at least said, you know, there's damage, but the roof was in such disrepair, you know, even after because they prorate that roof down, they'll say,
sure.
You know,
sure.
If it's a 25-year-old roof, you might get, you know, $20. I mean, I'm just throwing a number out. But if the roof was in disrepair, at least they have to tell you is, you know, yeah, the roof is so far gone, you know, that if you don't get it done, then we're going to cancel you. If they give you a chance, did they say if you fix your roof within 90 days, you know, you're still in our policy?
No.
Oh, yeah. You know, I would go to that. And you know, maybe I'm full of beans, you know, but I would you know, I would check with the insurance division and, you know, just say here, you know, have all your documentation, say, okay, this happened on this date. This is the phone call I made. That's why I like people to really keep track of all their phone calls, who they talked to, you know, what the topic was. That just doesn't seem the best way of handling that, just to cancel you.
I agree. And definitely get a second opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Get a second opinion, a third opinion, you know, and get you know, as many people as you can, you know, backing you up. Sometimes what you can do is if you cut, maybe a couple of the shingles off and send them to the manufacturer and say, hey, you know, would you tell me what's going on? Is this just normal? You know, it's 25-year shingle, and I understand that I'm going to have to replace it. That's normal. Or has there been, you know, hail damage? And, you know, the company will run tests, and they'll say, well, yeah, it's always also been damaged by, you know, hail. You know, I would get a hold of that division and clear it up with them and say, hey, you know, what's my recourse? I just don't feel I was treated right. I'd get on that agent, though, and say, hey, you know, you've been sitting on my money for 25 years. That's kind of the way I look at it all the time is I've, in good faith, you know, giving you money every, you know, monthly or 6 months or every year, and now it comes time for you to stand by my side. Where are you?
Right. Okay. So Jim should get started with the Iowa Insurance Division, you think?
I would. Yeah. Somebody like that, you know, and I've been told, you know, there's the ombudsman, you know, can get a hold of. There's the, you know, Iowa Attorney General. But I would go with someone that's involved with the industry.
All right. Jim, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Brent is on the line in Story City. Hi, Brent.
Hi. I've got a house that was built about 2001 and sided with Hardy Plank siding. And about 10 years later, it had some problems in a couple of patches where the hardy plank had gotten soft from moisture, mostly snow laying up against it, but in some other places where it could only have been rain. And we replaced some of those areas, and that's fine. And I repainted the heck out of them and repainted the areas that we didn't replace as well. But 3 years later, 2 years later, I've got paint peeling off of those areas where I repainted, and I can't seem to keep paint on those spots. And they're not spots that I would expect to be particularly troublesome. It's a south wall. It's got a little shade on it, but, you know, it's not some place where water would accumulate, and it's not in the areas where the snow used to lay up against it. So
sure.
What do I do to get this stuff to stick?
Well, you know, Hardy and all the other, you know, cement board, you know, we call them cement board, but it's mostly wood. Cement board manufacturers, when they first came out, you know, they were all pretty sure that, you know, they were going to hold up very well. And it's just, you know, we've all found out, including me, that if there's any place where there's moisture comes against, especially close to the ground or where water splashes on it, it gets funky, it kind of decays.
Yeah, this is 8 or 9 feet up, though.
Yeah, well, so that's, you know, this is the case is the reason that paint's coming off is moisture's getting to it from the backside. So
Okay. What's
happening is somehow, you know, moisture is in the wall, you know, maybe there's a flashing issue, you know, the water's getting behind the siding. When you put the siding back on, did you back prime it? Did you paint the backside?
Yeah, I think so. I dimly recall that, but I can't testify for certain under oath.
Well, okay. Yeah, I couldn't either. So, you know, that a lot of times that's the cause of somehow moisture's getting into it, either like at the lap, you know, where maybe it didn't get painted quite enough there. When you have driving rain, sometimes water, every 10 mile an hour, water will climb an inch. So if the siding's only lapped over an inch, if there's any rain-driven water, it'll get behind there, and it could get on the backside. And normally when it falls off the face, it's not the siding. It's just moisture getting into it somehow. It's kind of like the old houses when we did in the 70s. Paint fell off all the time because we didn't understand moisture inside walls, and we blamed the paint, and it was actually water in the siding.
Okay.
So I'd maybe pull one of those off if you can, maybe a section, and then get have someone with a moisture tester test and see how wet that siding is. And then it's probably some water getting in from behind.
What kind of numbers would be too high? I have a moisture tester.
You know, I'd be a little worried. I'm sure, hopefully, you know, somebody call in and say that number's all full of beans there again. But, you know, if it's above, say, like 11%, 15%,
okay,
it shouldn't be any higher. It shouldn't be much higher than that. But you probably won't even need a sensor because you'll be able to feel it.
Okay.
There's one thing about the cement boards is if there's much moisture in it at all, it becomes fairly pliable.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it's pliable and kind of punky, like where you had it in the wet places, then yeah, it's probably coming in from behind.
Okay. Well,
that's,
see if we can figure out where it's coming.
And the bad thing is that's usually where it gets expensive.
All right.
The source.
Well, Brent, thank you so much for your call, and good luck with that. Next up, let's go to Lynn in Waukee. Hi, Lynn.
Yes, I'm calling to ask a couple questions about a footing. And so my footing is, I guess, the regulation length or depth, which would, I don't know if those are set by local jurisdictions or by state jurisdiction, like it's some 42 or 46 or 48 inches or whatever. I know that. The issue is I have a porch that is falling, that the footing, I think, is not deep enough for the circumstance. And the circumstance is that this was created on a cornfield, but we have a decorative, like, little hill where our front door and a porch abuts. In other words, they pushed a lot of dirt up there to make it look like, you know, and a rock wall, et cetera. So
yeah,
the sidewalk leading up to the front door is all tilting, and the footing that holds up the front porch is, that footing is the one in question. And if it's the regulation amount deep, is there supposed to be a different regulation for a created by a bulldozer hill? Should the footing have gone, say, twice as deep or down to the ground where, you know, the real flat part actually was before they started creating this development?
There you go. You hit it right on the head on the last part because, you know, if this porch has a roof attached to the house, right?
Yes.
Okay, well.
And I have leakage.
Because, yeah, okay. Well, then, yeah, because it's settling away. So
exactly.
That porch. Yes, that porch, the footing should have gone, you know, let's say they brought in 5 feet of soil. Those footings for that porch, since it's attached to the house with walls and a roof, it's different if it was a deck.
Okay.
Since that roof's attached to the other house, those footings have to go all the way down to good. I mean, not just the original soil, but there might have been some real soft black dirt on the top, they have to go down to a good bearing soil. So,
and is that a rule, or is that just what you think is good practice?
No, the building inspector would require that to go all the way down to good soil. That's not a a guess or anything or something you can get by on.
Okay.
Because normally that would have to go down 4 feet, and sure, that's fine if it's original
soil. The issue is because the roof is attached to this post that's holding up this roof, that makes it a different rule than just if it's a deck.
Yes, because now that thing is attached. It's like a room.
Okay.
So basically, you know, you kind of look at it as most of my house is on a basement, and then I put a house that's on stilts, you know, an addition on stilts. Yeah, those have to go all the way down. And, you know, there's been cases where we worked on a project one time. We were close to 18, 19 feet down the ground.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Because
you
we
have
brought
helped
in all this
me.
Extra soil.
You have helped me a lot. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Lynn. It's Talk of Iowa. Yes, Bill.
I'm sorry. On that sidewalk, I wanted to say, too, is now that sidewalk, normally when they put that in, if there's a lot of fill, there has to be a lot of compaction done on that ground if they're going to set the sidewalk on. Otherwise, they're going to tear it out, put it in. It's going to settle again. They're just going to keep doing it over and over and over until they get good bearing underneath that sidewalk as well.
All right. So that sounds like a project for a very big piece of equipment.
Yeah.
Okay. It's Home Improvement Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's a question from Susan in Jewell. She says, a couple of months ago, Bill mentioned that a dripping sound in a caller's wall wasn't because of water. The dripping sound was because of the PVC or drain exhaust pipe. The one that comes out of the roof in the bathroom was expanding or something. I have a new PVC drain pipe that comes out of the roof in an upstairs wall. When the hot water's running, it makes a dripping sound. And I know there aren't any water pipes in that area. What is making the noise?
I remember that call.
Yeah.
Because what it is when moisture or warm air or warm water go through that, you know, your plastic pipe, your drain vent, is that plastic expands and contracts. And sometimes when you put that pipe through wood framing, if the pipe is touching the wood in any way, if they didn't, you know, make the hole a lot bigger and like, say, put some caulking around it or something, but if it's just touching the wood someplace, as it expands, it makes this tick, tick, tick noise. And it sounds just like there's water dripping, and you're digging around for it, and all it is that plastic expanding and contracting, because then it goes away after a few minutes. So if they have, you know, they still have that, just somebody's going to have to climb around someplace and find where that pipe is touching and cut the wood away from it.
All right. Or it's just going to keep making that tick, tick, tick sound.
Yeah, that's great. It's funny, I remember that call.
All right, let's go next up to Carol in Marion. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, my deck is peeling very bad. I think it was painted just before I bought it 4 years ago, just to make it look good. And I was wondering about this new thick paint that they've come out with, Rust-Oleum. Rust-Oleum has one called Restore. Do you know about that?
You know, I've seen the ads, too, and I've got a friend that's going to try that. I'm curious to see how it's going to work. Normally, Rust-Oleum products are really good. I mean, I've had really good luck with them. I've used them for some of their epoxies and stuff. And I'm really anxious to see how that works as well. But I'm sure that they're going to say, you know, wherever there's any peeling or things like that, that you're going to have to, you know, maybe power wash it or prep it so that product still...
I think sanding it would be good.
If it what? I'm sorry?
Sanding.
Yeah, that probably would. I would, go to where you might purchase that and then get the directions.
Okay. And, I know you have to wash it. You have to pre-wash it, I think.
Yeah, and in some cases, you know, they'll, in the directions it'll ask, basically, you know, how far gone the deck is and... And, they may have you wash it with, say, TSP, you know, the TSP powder.
Yeah.
And really get that cleaned up. You're right. But I'm really anxious to see how that works, because I think that could end up, you know, being a really big hit for people.
I went online and read some reviews. it seemed like the ones that were down south, the people said, oh, my gosh, I put that on, and now it's I have to take it off, and it's going to be a big problem. But then the ones up north that I read in the northern part of the country, they seem to be satisfied with it. So,
well, it just goes to show that we're a lot smarter up here than they are down there,
oh,
I guess.
Oh,
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe down south it's sticky when you walk onto it. Yeah, that wouldn't be too neat.
Maybe the heat has something to do with it.
It may, because, you know, when we used to have those, the early man-made decking material, they really had problems down south because they heated up so bad and expanded, contracted. And so, you know, it might have to go through a couple generations before it works really good for everybody.
All right, Carol, thank you so much for your call, and good luck with that project. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is on the line with us today, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here with us today, here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Richard in Mount Vernon is already looking ahead to next winter. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hi. I have I'm calling about ice dams and what I can do now to prevent them. I have a 1904 house. It's kind of a T-shaped house with a dormer, and I had a lot of trouble with an ice dam coming down the front of the house onto a more shallow pitched porch. And I'm just wondering what I can do now so that I don't have the ice dam problem next winter.
Okay, well, do you have... let's say that T part that sticks out, you know, where the valley is part of it in the shade and
yes.
then part of it in the sun?
Yes.
Okay,
I guess it would be fair to say that it's in the shade most of the day.
Okay, so up above that shady part, though, that's probably in the sun, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's the case, you know, where if you do a lot of research on ice dams, majority of the time people will say, you know, it's because of heat loss, you know, not enough insulation in your attic, and that's probably what maybe be causing a lot of yours. But in cases like even on my own house is I have a lot of insulation, it's airtight and everything, but I have the exact same situation as you, is where the upper part of the roof gets in the sun melts it off, and then the water comes down and it gets into that area that's shady, and then it refreezes.
Yeah, that would fit perfectly
here. Because the sun's not hitting it. Yeah, and so you, on that one, you probably have bigger ice dams on one side of the T than the other one, don't you?
The ice dam is parallel to the T section in the house.
Oh,
so.
Okay, I've got you. Yeah, so.
And then there's a dormer, and so the valley's really created by the T section and then the dormer.
I've got you. The thing is, you know, the best thing to do is get in the attic, have, you know, someone that that understands how to insulate properly, or you can do it yourself. You try to stop any air first. You try to stop any air leakage from getting from your ceiling up into the attic, because a lot of times we'll add a lot of insulation in, you know, where the overhang is or where the roof and the wall meet.
Right.
And we add all this insulation, and it doesn't do a doggone thing because we didn't stop warm air from coming up from below. So you have to air seal that first by finding any air leaks. So if there's any seams or wires or anything, you foam them in or caulk them in, and then you insulate that area to try to stop, you know, any heat loss there. But, you know, I'm still betting that even if you do all that work, you're still going to have a little bit of ice dam problem there because of the way the house is built. And that's why a lot of people have them no matter what they do for heated loss. So what you can do is, you know, where it probably builds up quite a bit, right, where the shallow one and the steeper one meet, doesn't it? I mean, it gets pretty thick there.
Yes, yes.
And that's two stories tall?
Yeah, it's two stories.
Okay, well, what I did is I knew I was going to have problems, so when I roofed it, under the shingles, I have ice and water shield, which is basically a real heavy kind of a sticky membrane that when the nails go through the shingles, that it's sealed around them so that you can basically flood it and it won't get wet. I did that for preventative measures, knowing I was going to have some ice dam problems. So,
yeah, I was trying to stay away from re-roofing the house.
Yeah, and so what I would do first is probably the majority of it, if you can get the air sealing down and get some extra insulation in there. And in some cases, this is a really good place for foam insulation. Do your due diligence and have somebody that knows how to spray foam correctly, because there's some really good cases where they've sprayed the underside of the roof deck just in that area where you have the ice dams. And so then the water that's coming down the roof actually will go farther, stay in liquid form, farther down the roof and not freeze as fast. And in your case, that may be just enough so you don't have the ice dam.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The air leakage and the insulation is the big key.
Yeah, I've seen these external wires. Are they worth investigating or no?
They scare the heck out of me. We used to use them a long time ago. I used to put them up for people, and they scare me. And your insurance agent gets a little nervous, too, because you're putting holes in there. Sometimes they have clips, they have all these things. But a lot of times what they'll do is they'll actually make it worse because they'll melt where they're at, and then it refreezes again and makes it even worse down the roof farther. I check with your insurance agent first, but that's kind of your last resort.
All right, Richard, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Barbara in Kelowna. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I have a 20-by-40-foot room with a separate thermostat, and I hardly use it in the winter, and I'd like to know how low I can set that thermostat without damaging the drywall.
There's a lot of opinions out there. I kind of like that magic 55 degrees, because you get expansion, contraction, and if you go much below 50, you might get some cracks in the paper. Now, I know a lot of people will let it go down into the, even the low 40s, but the problem there becomes is that's one room, but you've got air coming between rooms, through the walls and that. You can run into some cases where if one room, say, 40 and one room is 70, you can reach a condensing point somewhere in the wall and actually start getting moisture in your walls. And you probably want to hear me say a lot lower, but I'd feel a lot more comfortable if it was, like, right on 55 because I just feel it's a lot better for the structure of the building.
All right, Barbara, thank you so much for your call. A lot of people are thinking about winter today, I guess.
Good. Security?
Yeah.
If it goes dark here on my phone, it's because I was whistling the theme song at the break. I had my window down, and some guy walking with his wife saw me whistling, and he gave me a look. So if I get poked because I was whistling,
all right, we'll know why.
You'll know why. Yeah.
Oh,
it's a real
dear.
Bad look.
Wow, we had no idea what the dangers were when we picked that theme song. All right. Well, hopefully everything is okay. Here's a question from email. This is from Lori. Painting kitchen cupboards is very popular on television home improvement shows. Does the paint hold up well?
Yeah, it'll hold up just right. It's just in the prep. What probably the best thing to do is take one of the doors to wherever you're going to get the paint. Instead of you trying to guess whether, it's got two layers of a lacquer on there or two layers of oil or, latex, take it to where you're going to buy the paint and say, hey, what prep do I need to get so that this finished coat is going to look good? And because, you're going to have to decide, do I want it to be perfectly smooth? Do I want to have a little bit of a texture? Because I know some of the people are kind of putting that, it's almost like a kind of a little bumpy surface, almost like a real light drywall on their door, kind of a textured finish to it rather than smooth. I've been seeing that a little bit. So take that, and then you can really discuss what finish I want and what's going to be best for the prep, and then you're all set to go.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Tom is on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm in the process of putting some fiberglass insulation in a 2x4 wall. It's an outside building that will see occasional heating in the wintertime. And I'm using craft-faced insulation. Would I be wrong in putting any kind of a vapor barrier like a Visqueen over top of that, or should I just leave the craft-faced vapor barrier in place?
Have you already bought the craft-faced?
Yeah, I can return it, though, but my question is
craft-faced is the one thing, you know, we used to use it all the time, and the bad thing about craft-faced is it's a vapor retarder in the middle of the, you know, where the middle of the paper is, not on the edges, because of all the air gaps, and then it kind of hides it. You don't get the insulation completely in that cavity because you can't see it because of the paper, especially on top and bottom.
Okay.
So buy the friction fit instead and get R13 friction fit, get R11, get R13, and normally it takes longer to put in fiberglass than any other insulation because you need to cut it where every wire is. You know,
right.
If that cavity is 11 inches wide, you'd never compress it or roll it. You cut it to fit. And then what I really like, and it does cost a little more, is it's called CertainTeed membrane.
Yeah, I use that on the ceiling.
There you go. Put that on the walls as well. And then when you paint it, make sure you only use latex paint, no oil, and then you'll have somewhat of a forgivable wall.
Okay.
And basically what you're doing then right there, that meets, actually in parts of the state, that meets the energy code if you had foam on the exterior. But putting that insulation in right, you're doing it correctly. And
okay.
Membrane is a really nice product. But there again, you know, on the outside walls where you have receptacles or switches, you know, normally you put a receptacle that has a rubber gasket around it, so you can seal your membrane to it with a sealant. Can you still do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. And you're good. That way, as long as you make that wall, you know, airtight, it's going to perform well, but yet moisture vapor will be able to go through and keep the wall dry. So, yeah, just be sure and seal it on the bottom plate, top plate, around the window, and on the receptacles, the switches, and
okay.
You're going to have a really good system. I'm really glad, you know, I'm just curious, who told you that about the membrane to put it on the ceiling?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Did a builder tell you? Or?
I used unfaced fiberglass for the ceiling. And
okay.
I knew that if I had unfaced, then I had to use the vapor barrier. So I was going to use Visqueen, but my wife thought this might be a better product. And I really liked it, except it has such a high tensile strength that when a screw would break through near the edge of the sheet, you could actually see it trying to pull the plastic in.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah.
I was really impressed with how strong it was.
Yeah.
But it was easy to work with, and I really liked it.
We need to hire your wife because she knows she's right on top of things. I hope she's listening. This gets the point because that's, you know, she's in that top 5 percentile bracket right there, knowing that that's what that product's for.
Yeah. Well,
that's
I learned
really
a long
good.
Time ago to listen to what she says. So.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah,
thank
fine.
You.
You bet. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tom. And next up, Jerry is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Bill.
Hey.
Thank you for having me on. I have a 1921 Craftsman in Des Moines. I am looking at what I'm calling an aging-in-place project. I have a long list. New roof, paint the exterior, tear out a tub and put in a nice walk-in zero shower on the first floor, do some window work on the first floor, either replacement or rehab. Got a little concrete work maybe to do, some tuck pointing of foundations. So I am a member of Center on Sustainable Community in Des Moines, COSC. They have recommended a guy in Ames who can come down and walk through all of this stuff with me and help me prioritize, make a plan, and then I believe that I can be my own general and just engage my individual roofer, heating, cooling. And I'm wondering if you have any opinions about picking up someone to actually give you that heads up before you start doing all that work.
You know, I know him personally. We worked on a lot of projects together, and that's probably one of the best investments you could make, because his first name is Dave. That, you know, that's fine. Dave is extremely knowledgeable, and he'll walk you through the entire house, and you'll find stuff that you would never think of. I know if I took him to my house, he would find so many things that, you know, you just kind of look over because you see him every day. And he can prioritize things for you. He can tell you which ones, you know, especially for aging in place, which ones are best, which are long-term things to look at, which are going to give you an immediate effect, you know, give you rough ideas of what they're going to cost so you can set a budget. And then he can also set you up with, you know, a maintenance schedule on everything that you choose to do. I wish more people would take advantage of services like that. It takes a lot of the headaches away from you, and I know Dave does a really good job with that. I would highly recommend it for anybody, especially if you're looking at, you know, all the projects, you know, that you're looking at. I mean, you're running the whole gamut here on the house, and he's really good at helping with universal design as well. As you know, this is going to be the best for you, for comfort, for indoor air quality, and he knows an awful lot about, you know, moisture issues and how to make the house healthier. So, I'd highly recommend it.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Jerry. Last call of the day, Doug in Mount Vernon. Hi, Doug.
Hello.
Hi. Hello. Quickly, what's your question?
House was built in 1981 and moved to wood foundation in 1989. We're contemplating buying it. What do I have to worry about? A wood foundation.
If it was put in correctly, nothing. I have one in my house, and my best friends, we put them in for them as well. One thing you want to check is if you can get access to it, find out who did it, what materials they used, and what the house is sitting on. Because there were some packages sold by some companies that really weren't up to snuff. What you want to do is get down there and look, and usually they're a two by eight. They're an 8-inch thick wall with 3/4-inch plywood on the outside, sitting on either a gravel footing or a concrete footing over gravel. And you want to make sure that somewhere on that wood it will say AWF all weather, or AWWF all weather wood foundation, or it will have like FDN printed on it somewhere for foundation grade, and it'll have a 0.6 for treatment. But I would find out who did it and get as much as you can, because I'm telling you, they are so stinking strong when they're put in correctly, and when they're done correctly, they don't settle whatsoever. In fact, the one time I put one underneath, at the time it was the most expensive home in town, and the guy had worked with this treated lumber before, and he said, you know, this wood's going to be around till everything else is dust. But there again, it all depends on who did it and what it's sitting on. It should be on well-drained gravel, and then how they backfilled it as well. I would have absolutely. In fact, for me, it's an upgrade.
All right, Doug, thanks a lot for your call. And, Bill, we're out of time, but thank you so much for taking the time. I hope you missed a lot of digging.
Me too, Charity. Thank you for getting me out of it.
All right, my pleasure, and hopefully I'll get to see you in the studio next month.
You bet. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks a lot. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, on the show today. He'll be back next month. Tuck of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Tuck of Iowa.